good morning, good evening, or whenever you happen to be listening, whether it be on your jog, in your car, or outside your court-appointed public defender's office, Skiffy is oozing beyond IRC and using advanced technology for measuring micro-changes in air density. We found a way to enter your brain more directly and with less resistance than ever before.
That's suitably creepy.
I'm your do-nothing Chanop, and suddenly also your host, Snaked.
And I'm your Minister of Pain and co-host, Dasmi.
So, Dasmi, how are you enjoying life in my basement?
I don't know, man. It smells like you. There's nothing to eat but chicken feet, and the only thing to watch is your extensive collection of Nepalese comedies.
Well, what if I told you there was a television series where Charlie's Angels were the Breakfast Club, Charlie was a giant floating head, and he gave them the power to stop invaders from the moon with their karate and multiple giant robots to fight Godzilla's enemies. And to top it off, the whole thing feels like a live-action cartoon with fretboard-tapping pop metal tying the whole thing together.
I would watch the hell out of that show.
Well, boy, do we have a treat for you. Joining us tonight is David J. Fielding, who you know as the voice of Zordon on the Mighty Morphin Power Rangers. David, how are you doing?
Good, good. I was the voice and face of Zordon. So,
that's right. You also had the face. Well, hey, for those of you who might be unfamiliar, we do have some people who are going to be unfamiliar in our group, whether you can believe it or not. Could you introduce the show and your character in it?
Sure. The Power Rangers was a children's television show in the early 90s. It was a superhero show on the Fox Kids Network about a group of teenagers with attitude that were recruited by... an intergalactic wizard trapped in a time warp, my character of Zordon, to help battle the evil Empress Rita Repulsa and her minions. And it was all very flashy and color coordinated, and it was all done in order to sell a lot of merchandise. So it was very light on plot, very heavy on action, and very goofy and cheesy, as some of us are wont to say. So yeah,
that's right. I do remember that pretty much everything on screen was something that you could beg your parents to purchase for you.
Pretty much, yeah.
All right. So how did you get attached to this? How did you land the role?
It was a very interesting case of like networking. When I went to college, I went to Southwest Texas State University in San Marcos, Texas, which is now just Texas State. But at the mm-hmm. time, it was Southwest Texas State. And I made a bunch of friends there. A lot of them moved out to California before I did. I had, once I left Southwest, I went to the University of Pittsburgh to get my master's of fine arts in acting. And when I was done with that program, then I followed a bunch of them out to Los Angeles. And within 2 months of landing in L.A., a friend from Southwest, Stacy Fish, who had been working at Saban at the time, doing production work on some of their straight-to-video movies that they had been doing back then, like Maniac Cop and stuff like that, she called me up and said, hey, we're having an audition for this role, for this kids television pilot. Would you want to come down and audition for it? And that's exactly what I came to LA to do. So I said, sure. And I thought it was going to be like any other cattle call audition for a project in LA. You go down, there's 15,000 other guys, you read the lines, you get put on tape, you go home and you never hear anything. But when I got down there to the Saban building that evening, it was just me and another guy. And I found that to be very unusual. And they told us that they were going to cast it that night and shoot it the next week and to make sure that I was available and blah, blah, blah. And so we separated into our individual corners. He read his bit and I read mine. And then they took him into the room to read to the cast and everything. And he was in there for about 30 minutes or whatever. Oh, wow. And then he came in and then he came out and he left and they brought me in and introduced me to the cast, the director, the producers, the writers. And then they had me stand up on a table and I did the part using the voice that ended up being in the show. And that was that. I went home, and a couple hours later, got the call saying, congratulations, you booked the part. And the next week, I was sitting in a chair and got all my hair shaved off. So it was pretty awesome.
Well, first of all, I do love the image of you standing up on the table, because that to me is like the perfect, well, oh, we should call it a table read, mimicking the set that your character was. I know that was terrible.
the depth of humor.
Anytime that once the show got picked up, and anytime the actors were in the command center talking to Zordon, they were always looking up at him. And I think that was one of the reasons why they did that, was to sort of get them used to the idea that Zordon was larger than life and somebody that they were always looking up to. So,
yeah, and it must have put you in that mentality as well.
For one time, yeah, because the sad thing is they only filmed the character once, and then like all the other Japanese footage that they were using, they just used that over and over and never had to pay me for it. So it was pretty sweet deal.
From their perspective, absolutely. Yeah, that's right. It didn't really occur to me until I went back and watched several episodes in preparation for talking to you, that Zordon was a chroma keyed character. So that in the early 90s was, you know, not cheap to do. And also his lips were never really distinct on screen.
Right. They fuzzed that over so that whatever dialogue they wrote for the character, they could just plug it in willy nilly. And it didn't really have to matter. It's not like the production values were super high on the show anyway, but I mean, they did a lot of very smart things from a production business standpoint. It just really sucked from a performer standpoint, how things played out. But that being said, I mean, the resurgence of nostalgia and comic cons and everything now, I'm sort of reaping the benefit of the residuals that I should have made on the show. That weren't there at the time, so it worked out. You know.
About how long, just as a guest, did you actually spend shooting the part?
If memory serves me right, I was in the chair for about 4 or 5 hours. We did a number of takes. It was the very last thing that they shot for the pilot, and they had been going for a number of weeks. So everybody on the crew, including the director, they were all sick. They had the sniffles and were sneezing, and when we shot, they were all like 30 yards away from me and, you know, talking to me through a bullhorn because they didn't want to get me sick or anything like that. And
right.
So I sat under the hot lights in this like barber's chair with nothing but a bald head and green latex paint to get up against a big green wall. And they shot me for like 4 or 5 hours while we did different takes, and then I did a bunch of facial expressions, different angles, different improvised lines that they could just, you know, use whatever they want to. Had I known at the time that they were going to recycle the footage, I would have, you know, maybe not have tried so hard. at the time, you know, the show hadn't been picked up. It was just a pilot. And so they were I signed my day player contract and got paid what little money they gave me, and I went home thinking that, okay, that was fun, and I didn't really expect it to go anywhere. So, but surprise, surprise, it did.
It certainly did. You know, I think there was a period circa 1993 where there was not a third grade playground that didn't have a few Power Rangers on it.
Yeah, I think we're responsible for a lot of broken lamps and some other household items that, you know, heirlooms that got destroyed or something. So, yeah.
Okay. And probably some younger siblings as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Broken fingers or whatever. So, yeah.
Well, we can all laugh about it now.
No, all right. We laugh about it every weekend. So.
Right. So, when the show, was picked up, and you're recording heavily from what we've learned from some of the other actors, it seemed like there was a lot of material being recorded very quickly. In a
In an interview that we watched, Catherine Sutherland, who was the second Pink Ranger, observed that during filming, she never quite knew what was going on because they had fragmented access to scripts and they were shooting multiple episodes at once. Was your experience similar, or did being an exposition-giving character give you a better bird's-eye perspective?
I was very separated from everybody else. While the main cast was busy shooting four episodes every 2 weeks, I was only called in like every 5 or 6 weeks to do voices for whatever episodes were finished and were almost in the can. So I got to see sort of like the 90% finished product of the scene that I was in. Not the whole episode, but mainly just all the stuff that was happening in the command center. But those guys had a really brutal schedule. They had 16 to 18 hour days. They were, I think the only day they had off was like a Sunday.
Oh, geez.
But from Monday through Saturday, they were there from sun up to sundown, well past that. And, they were going like gangbusters, and the first season had 60 episodes, so they were put through the grinder, really. Those guys were. And Catherine's right. I mean, the way that the scripts were broken up, say like on a Wednesday, that was the one day they were going to do all the command center stuff. So they had to do four episodes worth of command center stuff in one day. They had to change costumes four times. They had to, you know, learn their lines and be in the scene for that one day. And then they would go on to the next day and, like, you know, be shooting fight scenes in the park or wherever it was they were doing. So it was very jumbled and very it seems like it's controlled chaos. You know, it's a patchwork kind of way of working, but it's all scheduled out very, very strictly about what needs to get done on what day and so forth and so on. But when you're in the middle of it, it's very confusing.
So did you ever make a habit of watching episodes as they were completed? Did you see the stories come together beyond the command center scenes that arrived in your care to voiceover?
Not really. I was not given a whole lot of preview of what was happening. I mean, I only watched them, like, because when we were doing all that, it was still early 1992. The show didn't go on the air until August of 93, so there wasn't any real way to sort of like watch a finished episode unless Tony Oliver, who was the head writer at the time, he and I had a really great relationship, and I was working on my writing then, and I would send him script ideas and we would talk stuff back and forth. But on a rare occasion, I might get to see 10 minutes of a completed episode and just sort of like get a better understanding of what Zordon was trying to convey to the characters, because every week there was a some sort of strange monstrosity that he had. You know, here's a giant purse monster, and what are you going to do about that? And so there was a little bit of that, but for the most part, I didn't see the episodes until they were actually on television. So.
Okay. You know, I wonder about your relationship with the character then, because, you know, it's your voice, it's your face, but also the space that he occupies is also very much part of who Zordon is. And with the kind of fragmented coordination between recording your parts and the rest of the cast, I'm wondering if your sense of who this character is emerged separately from your work in the actual recording booth.
The only backstory I was ever given was that he was a 10,000-year-old wizard. He was trapped in the time warp. That was it. Go. And at the beginning, Zordon was nothing more than an exposition deliverer. He would tell you, this is the situation. This is what's happening. You need to go take care of it. As the show went on, and after I left, I mean, they continued to use my face throughout the life of the character, but I stopped voicing the character after episode 31 because I had left LA. But I think as the character and the show grew, the relationship between the character and the Rangers also became more dynamic. I think Zordon is very unique in as a mentor character, in the fact that he's never hands on. He never helps out physically to solve the situation for the Ranger. He can't. I mean, he's separated from them by time and distance. So he is a very encouraging entity. Someone who constantly tells them, "I know you can do this. I believe in you." And so I think that's a very positive message for the kids that were watching the show at the time, that they had this voice that was behind them, but didn't solve problems for them. It left it up to them to sort of like find the strength within themselves to take care of the business that needed to be taken care of. So I always find that that's very interesting and quite a sophisticated concept for, say, a 5 or 6 year old to sort of process. So I thought that was very interesting, that as cheesy and as hokey as the show was, they had they did have these elements that were very life affirming or very, you know, very positive. So,
you know, that's something that occurred to me in some of my rewatches of a few favorite episodes. You talk about that. In addition, there was messaging, especially in, say, the juice bar sequences, where, you know, if a parent is engaged with the show, with the kid, there's a morality play every episode that, you know, they can talk out or connect to, or, you know, a kid watching alone, connecting to the characters. They do have that. I like the way you put it, that affirming voice, you know, empowering the characters, and, you know, maybe the viewer touches upon that a little bit as well.
Yeah, I mean, the show itself came under a lot of scrutiny because of the violent aspect of it. In the early episodes, there were a lot of the way the fights and stuff were staged is that the actors ended up the Rangers would like kick the putties in the head and stuff, and the censors would come back and say, "You can't do that. You can't kick people in the head." So they had to go back and reshoot fight scenes to make sure that whenever they would be doing these things, it was always a body blow or something, you know, to the back, something that didn't look lethal or whatever. And in order to sort of like also steer them into a more positive direction, the kids, the actors ended up doing a lot of PSAs, you know, say no to drugs and that sort of thing. And, you know, really, again, trying to reinforce the ideas that stand up for your friends, you know, be a good teammate, and just look out for people. And so I think there was a whole campaign designed around trying to alleviate parents' worries and fears about kids wanting to kick each other in the face on the playground and stuff.
Right.
But yeah, other than that, I mean, you know, It's just an all around fun show. So, yeah, I mean, it's giant rubber monsters and big giant robots. I mean, you know, what's not to like? So,
yeah,
I was a huge kaiju fan growing up, and I loved watching Ultraman and Spectreman and Godzilla and all that stuff. So when I found out I was going to be on a show that started in Japan and started with that, I was in hog heaven. I thought that was the best thing ever. And that, you know, coupled with the fact that we were in the same hour with their X-Men cartoon that they were doing at the time. And I was like, geez, I'm the head of a superhero team. Professor X is the head of a superhero team.
Right.
That's awesome. So, yeah.
You mentioned, you know, the show was a little cheesy and hokey, like you mentioned. But now that I rewatch it as a 37-year-old, I'm like, this is awesome. It's just, it's fun. Like, yeah. The monsters are all, like, I watched a couple nights ago the Eye Guy episode. It was awesome. It's fun.
I don't know if you guys have had a chance to check out any of the comic books that have come out in the last couple of years from Boom Studios. But all of the artists and writers that put those comic books together, they grew up with the show. They adore the show. And it's really awesome to see the comics take those characters and those cheesy situations and then retell them in a way that's more modern and more vibrant today than it was back in the 90s. And it's really been great to see, you know, it's sort of like have new life breathed into it. And now that Hasbro has taken over the license, and there's, again, another line of action figures that have come out that people are just gobbling up like candy. And so
it's people our age now who want to put them on their desks at work for the nostalgia.
You know, those kids who watched it back then have kids of their own, and they're introducing them. And so there's two or three generations of people that are all Power Rangers fans. So it's very cool.
Yeah, you know, it's got to give you some pleasure to see that your original fans are now in their 30s, maybe with some younger siblings in their late 20s. And I wasn't aware of the comic. It sounds like there's content that's you know, kept up with the audience as it's grown up.
It's a very sophisticated comic book too. I mean, they just had a whole arc called Shattered Grid, which was about the character of Tommy from another dimension who goes dark and starts, you know, destroying other Rangers from other dimensions and trying to wipe out all other variations of characters from the Morphing Grid. And it's a very long, convoluted arc that has some very wonderful moments of pathos and danger and heroics. It's really, really well done. And we got a chance to do the voices again because Kyle Higgins, who was the chief writer of Shattered Grid, was at Power Morphicon, which is the big Power Ranger-centric convention that happens once every 2 years. We did a live read of the comic book there, which was fantastic. You can actually watch it on YouTube. But we also got to do the voices for the video game Battle for the Grid. So to be able to do the voice of the character after 26 years was very, very cool. It was awesome to be able to do them.
I can't even imagine.
And I'm looking at some of the art right now. It's beautifully drawn too, the comics.
Oh yeah. And the variant covers for the various issues, they do these really nice homage to covers from other comic books too. Like there's one of the covers is an homage to a Spider-Man comic and so forth and so on. And it's just very, very really well done how they've done it. So
I like that the visual homage is there, because when you describe Tommy in his interdimensional battles with different iterations of Power Rangers characters, it's sounding very, very Marvel-esque in terms of story.
Well, you know, the character, you know, the evil Tommy who is named Lord Draken, he kills the Tommy from our dimension. So, I mean, it's pretty dark in some aspects.
Yeah, actually, I do remember in the original run of the show, the introduction of Tommy as a character. And for those who might not be totally keeping up, Tommy became the Green Ranger. That was the first time that it felt like the characters were in like any serious peril. And it was coming from a peer. And on a kid's show, that was some... I don't know that I would call it dark, dark writing, but, you know, that put us into some grim territory.
Sure. I mean, if you look at the original Japanese Sentai that the Power Rangers is taken from, that season is also quite dark. I mean, the Green Ranger character ends up dying, and the Japanese Sentai series is so different from the American one. I mean, they're almost like two different animals, but... the Japanese were not afraid to, you know, to really sort of broach a lot of subjects that the Americans were, you know, treated everything with kid gloves or whatever. But
right, whereas we're getting our public service announcements.
Right, right. Which is why, you know, you have a lot of the fans who have grown up now and are very eager to see Power Rangers in a much more Avengers-like manner, where it's a little bit more realistic, a little bit, the stakes are a little bit higher, things are a little bit grittier, you know. So, and I think the comics do that well. They have a seriousness to them that the TV show didn't have.
So, David, you were describing when we first connected a sense of separation enforced by the nature of the production that you felt like was experienced both by you, the actor, and also the character. Do you feel like this informed your portrayal of Zordon at all?
Oh yeah,
obviously, I mean, or otherwise.
I think I connected with him right from the get-go because when we were doing the audition, I could hear the other gentleman across the room from me practicing his line, and he went for a more higher pitched take on the character, almost a cackling wizard type. And I thought that was really sort of the wrong way to go about it. I mean, for me, Zordon was always sort of like this Zeus-like character. He was up on high. He was distant from everybody. So I tried to give the character a resonance, something that was deep and booming, something that would speak to them. And I guess it worked because I've had a number of fans come up and tell me that they were scared to death of the character. That, here was this big giant head out of nowhere. It was like, what is that? And, you know, he would speak to them in a very direct, almost stern-like tone. So I think that's what I tried to convey every time that I was in the booth, and I think it worked.
Oftentimes it feels very paternal.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's exactly what they wanted. They wanted this father figure, but you know, he's completely hands off. There's nothing he can do. He's very impotent in a way, in the fact that he has no real power other than allowing the Rangers to access the morphing grid so that they can transform and fly wherever they need to and you know, wear the suits and battle whatever threat is there at Angel Grove on any given day. but other than that, I mean, he never really does anything. I guess you could talk for you know, a whole evening about the psychological implications of what that's all about. I mean, but I just thought it was a very interesting choice for them to have this all-powerful, all-knowing wizard, but at the same time, he was completely powerless.
Yeah. I do love that you make the Zeus connection, though, because, you know, I feel like the set is part of the character, and it feels like a shrine.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, you're at the very center of the light show.
Yeah. I wish I had actually been on the set. That would have been awesome. I've heard a number of times about the actors who were there. You know, they were looking at a blank wall. There was a tennis ball that they had pasted up on the wall, and that's what they were talking to. And they were hearing Zordon's lines being read by some PA who was getting paid minimum wage and was standing off the set going, so, you know, teleport to the command center. You know, didn't really inject a whole lot of.
Oh, that is a weird scene.
Yeah. I mean, I wasn't really doing a whole lot at the time. I'm like, they could have driven me out to the command center and I could have done the lines for the kids. But, you know, everything's about saving a nickel here and saving a dime there. So.
I will say the show impresses me a great deal in terms of what they got in terms of production out of what they seem to have spent. You know, they created a national
phenomenon with what looked like, you know, straight to video filmmaking budget.
Yeah, I don't know what their budget per episode was. I know for the time that I was on the show, I made less than $1,000, and they made $1 billion the first year. So
Jesus,
I think they did pretty well for themselves.
Yeah.
And just a reminder, Mr. David J. Fielding does sell autographs on his website.
Well, I mean, well, we don't have to push that.
you got back from a convention in Peru last week. How did that go?
It was very interesting. I've never been that far south on the continent, so I mean, it was great to be able to visit the country. It's a gigantic city. Lima is like 11 million people squashed together into like 40 something districts. And it was just very busy. It reminded me a lot of Jakarta. I got a chance to go to Jakarta, Indonesia as well. So there was so much traffic, and the hotel we were staying at, there was this constant just cars honking and beeping at one another, but the people there were wonderful. I mean, it's amazing to know that something I did one day 26 years ago has reached around the world and touched people in 40 different countries, and they all want to see us and say hello and tell us their stories about what the show means to them. And so to be able to travel to some place like Peru and to spend a few days listening to the people and partaking in their culture and seeing once again, you know, how much we are similar rather than we are different, and you know, how something like that brings everybody together was just awesome.
I have to imagine, you know, I don't think Zordon ever smiled, but I can hear the smile on your face thinking about your fans around the world here.
Yeah.
So, you know, you mentioned that you had only met the cast or you had very limited initial interactions with the cast before production began. But now you and several other Power Ranger veterans from multiple generations are out there on the convention circuit. Is this like a reconnection with them, or is it like forming a brand new relationship where you're coming at it from a shared experience?
It's kind of both. When I left LA, I just sort of like forgot about it. It was an interesting anecdote that I could tell people at parties. Oh yeah, I was on a TV show, but then I didn't pay that much attention to it. It wasn't anything that I was involved with anymore. So I just went on with my life and was doing things. And it wasn't until Facebook came along and I started reconnecting with old friends and stuff. And around 2011, I started to get some messages from people I didn't know asking me if I was on a TV show and did I play the character of Zordon on Power Rangers. And I was like, yeah, I did. And I was encouraged to create a Zordon Facebook page and sort of interact with fans. And in 2014, I got contacted by Scott Zillner, who owns Power Morphicon. And he asked me if I wanted to attend Power Morphicon that year. And I said, I'd love to. I can't afford to fly out and put myself up in a hotel. And he goes, oh, no, we'll take care of that. And that was sort of like my first introduction to how the convention scene sort of works. And it was very odd and uncomfortable for me at first that people wanted to give me money to put my name on something. I was very uncomfortable with that. So prior to going out to the convention, I was contacted by a group called No Hate, which is an anti-bullying, anti-discrimination campaign. And they asked me if I would be a part of the photo shoot that they were doing out there. And I said, I'd love to do that. Also, since I'm going to be out there, would you mind if I have a donation box on my table that if people want to give me money, I can donate to No Hate? And they said, that would be awesome. So when I was out there at Power Morphicon the first year, all the money that people would give me for stuff, I would put into the box. And I think I ended up donating like over $800 to No Hate that weekend. But then that was also the first weekend that I met my current booking agent, who really turned out to be sort of a lifesaver, because I had been bouncing from job to job and really didn't have anything going on back here in Texas when I was going to fly back. But because the booking agent wanted to start to book me in with some of his other Power Ranger clients, I found myself twice, three times a month, you know, going to different conventions and stuff. And I remember that first weekend at Power Morphicon asking if I could meet Austin St. John, Walter Jones, and David Yost, if they had time. And Zach was my booking agent, was like, yeah, of course. And Walter and Austin recognized me right away. They knew who I was. And I was very surprised about that. I was like, wow, we met once 25 years ago. Do you guys know who I am? They go, yeah, we know who you are. And so, and again, it's sort of like they welcomed me with open arms. And I don't know what it is about the casting process for the Power Rangers show, but every actor that I've met that has been a Power Ranger is the most big-hearted, wonderful person, you know, to be around. And so going to Knoxville, Tennessee, or New York Comic Con or whatever, and spending 4 days around these people, it's really a fun family type experience. It's not difficult or anything at all. It's just a lot of fun. And I've actually made made friends with quite a few of them, and we talk regularly. So I mean, it's sort of, I get to live my Power Ranger life now rather than when I was supposed to live it 25 years ago on the show. I get to live it now, so it's kind of fun.
I think it's so cool that you were basically invited back into the role by your fans.
Yeah.
And I have to wonder, since you left the show as a voice actor after, I think it was 31 episodes, but your face continued to be in use forever. I don't know. Do you feel like actors who came on the show as Rangers felt sort of a connection to you and your character, even though you hadn't met up until this point?
I know Rangers from later seasons, like Megaforce and Dino Charge, they grew up with the characters. So, you know, for them to be a young 12 or, you know, 11 or 12 year old and dreaming about being a Power Ranger, then becoming a Power Ranger, and then getting to meet Zordon for the first time, they have a little bit of a fanboy, you know, which is great. I mean, I'm sorry, I forgot the question.
So I was asking if you felt that any of the actors who came on the show or its spinoffs after you had left felt any sort of connection to you, because they had interacted with the character that you began and provided a face for, even though that you, the actor, became absent from the character at that point.
Well, for most of the actors in the Zordon area, they didn't really act with me. They acted with a wall or a
tennis ball, right?
but I mean, they all knew the character. They all knew who he was and so forth and so on. And even Christopher Kamen Lee, who played Andros, the Red Power Ranger that quote unquote kills Zordon, they never really interacted with the character, but the first time Chris and I met, you know, we were just like hugging each other and it's like, I'm so sorry I killed you. And I was like, no, it's fine. You know? it's all for the greater good, buddy. It's good. So I don't think that there was sort of like that they interacted with the character, but they interact with me when we're around one another, and I think that's better, if that makes sense.
It never even crossed my mind that kids who grew up watching the original series ended up acting in later iterations of it. That's incredible.
Peter Sudarso and Yoshi Sudarso, their brothers, Yoshi was on Dino Charge and Peter was on Ninja Steel. They both grew up with the show and they wanted to be Power Rangers more than anything, and they got to be them. And so that's very cool.
And again,
I think that's one of the biggest messages from the show that was there from the beginning, was that here were these kids from a variety of backgrounds who at the time were very diverse. I mean, you had, they were male Power Rangers. There were female Power Rangers. There was a black Power Ranger. There was an Asian Power Ranger. So, I mean, it spoke to a whole demographic of everybody. And that has just continued to go on through the following seasons. And I think what the message of the show is that it doesn't matter what the outer shell of the Power Ranger doesn't matter. It's what's underneath that really matters. And anybody can be a Power Ranger. And I think that's the message that gets delivered over and over. And when you hear somebody, when you hear stories like Peter and Yoshi, who wanted to be a Pounder and then became a Power Ranger, it just tells other fans that, if you work at it, if you want it, hard enough and really put in the time and the effort, that, yeah, it can come true. You can become a Power Ranger. So I think that's a great message for people.
It sounds like you became a patriarch of a clan without realizing it. But, I think next time you do one of these conventions, you need to bring a big bag of tennis balls for your colleagues.
Yeah, this is for you. I should do that. There's Zordon's tennis ball and have people. That'd be funny. That's funny.
Maybe Sharpie some faces on or something. So, hey, after your work on Power Rangers, you've gone through some interesting professional transformations. One was, I understand you did some work in the computer game industry. So what was that, and how did you get into it?
When I left L.A., I moved back to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I had a network of friends back there, and got back into doing stage work and started doing voices and stuff for radio and TV commercials there. And just outside of Pittsburgh, there was a small computer game company called Dreamforge, and they had contacted the booking agency that I was working at the time, saying, they needed somebody to come in and do voices for an action adventure game that they were working on. And I went out and I drove the 40, 45 minutes out to where they were headquartered, and went in there and auditioned for them, and ended up doing quite a number of games with them. They did some Gold Box Dungeons and Dragons games. I got to be the voice of Dritz Dewarden, the Dark Elf, in Menzo Baranzan. I got to do voices for Stone Prophet, which is a D&D game set in like an ancient Egyptian setting. I did voices for a game called Anvil of Dawn, which was like their version of a D&D game. The one I was most proud that we did with them was a game called Sanitarium, which was a psychological horror game. And I got to be the bad guy in that. And also, I got to do some writing for those guys. I did work on their instruction manuals and their clue books and stuff. So I was continuing to write as well as doing voice work. And then moved from Pittsburgh to just outside of Boston, and did some work for a couple of studios there, Impressions Games, who did some city builders. They started off with Caesar, which was a Roman city builder, and then they did two Greek ones, Zeus and Poseidon, and I actually got to be the voice of Zeus. So
full circle.
Yeah, it came full circle from Zordon to Zeus. And then I went to work for Stainless Steel Studios, and they did a real-time strategy game called Empire Earth. And I did 95 97% of the voices in that game, which means I was doing a lot of yells and unit deaths and stuff like that. And then I got hired on full time by a company called Mad Dog Software and worked with them for about 5 years doing design and script work and voice work for the games that we were working on to them. So, yeah.
I think design is the fantasy job that everybody looking in on the video game industry imagines themselves in.
It sounds like a fantasy job. It sounds really awesome, and it's very tedious.
well, give us a tedious example of the tedium.
Well, I mean, it's how do I put this? So when I started my creative career. I started off in acting, and the feedback loop for acting is very immediate. You know right away if the audience is not there. You know how to get them back. You get notes. So it's very quick, the feedback loop. And the further I went along in my career, that feedback loop lengthens for every job. So like when you do movies and stuff or a TV show, the feedback loop is months down the road. Like these guys that go out and do press junkets for movies, they're having to remember stuff they did a year and a half ago. Sort of the same thing with video games, in the fact that you design something, you implement something, you test something, and then you have to wait back for feedback from the the publishing company. So you send off the build and you wait maybe a couple of weeks or whatever until they come back and say you need to make these changes, whatever. And then there's a lot of repetition, there's a lot of squashing of bugs and making sure that the scripted triggers and stuff that you put in your levels worked the way that they're designed to, and not in a bizarre or different way. And sometimes the feedback loop is pretty quick, because if you have an in-house test team, they'll come back and tell you fucked up. You need to fix this right away. So, again, it's a lot of sitting there, testing something, putting it in, retesting something, over and over and over. And it's not as magical as it sounds on the outside.
That's me, who works in IT, as I'm sure smiling and nodding right now, as
yes.
Are a bunch of our as are a bunch of our dev friends, and you're speaking some familiar language here.
I mean,
yeah, except IT work isn't as fun as game design, but it's it's the same tedious process of try and test and fail and do it again.
Yeah. I mean, it's a very interesting atmosphere, because you're immersed in it. You're talking about games every day. You're working on games every day. You're sneaking an hour away to buy the latest game and test it and try it out and discuss that. And it also sort of like strips away any sort of illusions. It used to play a lot of video games and had fun with them. And then when you work in the game industry for a while, you're like, if I have to look at another video game, I will gouge my eyes out. Mm-hmm. But since I've been away from it for a long time, they're a lot more fun now. So, yeah.
What kind of games
the
do you play?
The healing process had time to take effect.
Yeah. What kind of games do I play now?
Yes.
I am enthralled with Red Dead Redemption 2. I play that a lot. I play the online component. Christopher Kamen Lee and Mike Jin. Mike Jin was the gold Power Ranger, and I can't remember what season he was in. But we've all got together on the PlayStation platform and have played Red Dead Redemption online together, and that's fun. To have the fans on the internet watch Power Rangers play video games, it's pretty wild.
That's awesome.
Assassin's Creed is a lot of fun. Very gigantic, huge open world running around as a Greek assassin. It was a lot of fun. I played Far Cry, a lot of Far Cry 5. I was really into city builders.
I just had to text my brother and tell him to play Red Dead Redemption Online. He's gonna be excited about that.
It's a beautiful game. I mean,
it is.
If you employ the cinematic camera and just watch your guy, you know, ride across the landscape, it's a beautiful thing to look at. It's very easy to pick up. It's easy to learn, and it really sort of captures that Westworld, Wild West immersive experience of, you know, it's nothing like what it must have been like to actually live in the Wild West. But I mean, it's that cinematic movie like Wild West that we all would want to be a part of. Mm-hmm. So,
which I think has to be much more fun than an authentic experience.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, yeah. get shot and then get back up. That's good. In the real world, not so much.
David, you've been an actor in a lot of short films, web series. We a few of us watched Strange Happenings.
I just saw you get stabbed in Strange Happenings last night.
What'd you think?
I enjoyed it. I'm not all the way through it. I think I'm in the middle of episode 3.
Yeah. Jason Brazier and Brittany Greer, they live in Missouri. They have their own little production house there, and they were fans of Power Rangers growing up, and they invited me to be a part of that, and so I went up to Missouri and worked with them, and we had a lot of fun. The premise of the show is very sort of X-Files, you know, lots of strange paranormal happenings, and this girl's trying to figure it all out, and so it was a lot of fun to be a part of that. Got a chance to do something I haven't done in a while, so it was good.
Yeah, and I gotta say, I have a lot of affection for productions at that level. You know, we look around at the current state of the internet with the promises of democratization of messaging and all that, and our content as well. But a lot of it is just, you know, pushing out your picture or your hot take on something. But seeing somebody put together a little production company, and even if it's straight to YouTube stuff, it's kind of joyful to watch, really. I mean, Strange Happenings, you watch it and you feel the warmth and enjoyment of the people who put it together there with you as you proceed through the series.
Yeah, and they've shopped it around to quite a few independent film festivals worldwide. I think it was in China or Korea that they had it as part of their festival out there. I mean, so it you know, it's making its way around, and they've won a number of awards and stuff. So I think it's really cool that they put a lot of work into it. They worked really hard to make sure that it happened, and they got it done. It's a finished product, and a lot of people can't say that. So I mean, it was really good for them to go out there and do that.
I think the expression is that real artists ship.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so that's cool. And I think we're also going to have to check out their earlier series, the what was it, The Drifter?
Drifter, yeah.
Because, you know, that kind of content is very much right down our alley. Oh,
yeah. Yes, it definitely is.
You like the post-apocalyptic stuff?
Well, theme, and you know, also that scale of production.
Yeah.
You know, it's you can sit down and watch a big budget AAA Hollywood whatever and walk away from that and think, well, yeah, I just watched a movie. You sit down and watch something like Strange Happenings, you're almost sitting on the couch next to the director as they point things out to you.
Yeah, it's very cool. I enjoyed it.
So, David, lately you've been also expressing yourself as a fiction author, publishing short stories, stage plays, and I believe at least one novel.
Yep.
And skimming through your publication list, we see macabre horror, steampunk, some detective stuff, and some superhero content. It looks like you are a nerd at play with a keyboard.
Well, you know, the old adage is, you know, write what you know. But I really just sort of write what I love. And I grew up reading Edgar Rice Burroughs and Doc Savage and comic books and watching and devouring all the Universal monster movies. And I saw Richard Donner's Superman in the movie theater 30 times. I loved HBO when it was in the early 80s, because they would play the same movies over and over and over. I saw Conan the Barbarian so many times. I saw Flash Gordon so many times, and Beastmaster and Sword and the Sorcerer. And I played D&D, and I was an actor, and I watched all those things and I absorbed all those things. And then I would embody those things on stage. And at the same time, I was always dabbling with putting down my own takes on characters and stories. And it starts off at, you know, like most things, you imitate. I was writing Tarzan stories. I was writing stories about you know, the shadow and stuff like that. And as I got older, I started, well, you know, I'll write the big fantasy novel. I'll write my own Lord of the Rings, or I'll, you know. And then you would try to, you know, play that out in D&D sessions and so forth and so on. And so it's always been a part of my makeup, I think, to try to use language and use words to tell a story that takes people on a journey. So, and then it was around 2010 that I started to get really serious about it. And like you said, you know, true artists are the ones that ship. Well, true writers are the ones that finish what they start. And so I had so many snippets of beginnings and snatches of stories that had been in my drawers for years that hadn't been finished. So I started finishing a bunch of stuff, and I learned a lot and got better at it. And then started submitting stuff to indie publishers. And because the publishing landscape has changed so much from what it used to be, thanks to the internet and self-publishing, there's so much out there now, so much more than what there used to be. I spent so much of my youth in bookstores and in libraries, just, you know, feeling the weight of a book in my hand, or the smell of the page, you know, under your nostrils, and wanting to be a part of that. So now that I've been able to do that, I mean, it's a very gratifying and also very frustrating endeavor to be a part of, but I wouldn't have it any other way. I love it. It's fantastic.
All right. Well, I will say I had the pleasure of reading Wobbly Bob, your contribution to Carnival of Horror, a little bit earlier. And it was not the weight of a book I felt in my hands. It was the weight of a Kindle. And maybe that's that is symptomatic of the changing landscape, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, I hope you enjoyed it.
I did. You know, the way the character was set up, I was kind of expecting a sort of morality lesson about how people who are different still have their inner beauty and all that. But the ending took us somewhere else, and I smiled at that.
Well, I mean, I guess the morality road is well trodden, and something that people, you know, it's easy to do or whatever. And since it was a horror anthology, and I had recently read a book called I think it was The Midnight Assassin, which is all about the first serial killer here in the States, which took place in Austin, Texas, and they theorized that that killer escaped Austin and fled to London and became Jack the Ripper. That's the theory. But to, you know, to sort of like add that character into the story, I thought was a lot of fun to play around with and, you know, twist things around. And plus the character of Wobbly Bob is very odd anyway. So it was fun to play around with it.
Yeah, that's evident reading it. All right. So, David, you have a film that you co-wrote and you're a co-producer on called The Order that's currently in pre-production. What can you tell us about this?
4 years ago, yeah, about 3.5-4 years ago, I'd been out enough doing conventions enough with the Rangers that I don't know how it came up, but Karen Ashley, who was the second Yellow Ranger, she was also Aisha in the Power Rangers movie and so forth. She's been wanting to do something with her fellow cast members for a while. And one of the questions we always get asked at conventions is, when are we going to see you guys doing something together? When are you going to get the team back together? You know, they want to see everybody back together. And so instead of waiting for Saban or whoever owns the show to sort of put together a greatest hits cast list, Karen said, I want to do something on my own. And she had mentioned something to Austin, and Austin said, well, you should talk to David. David's a writer. So Karen contacted me, and we started emailing back and forth. And she was telling me what she wanted to do, and it clicked really quickly. Karen and I have a great relationship as far as working together back and forth, because she lives in California, I live in Texas. So not being in the same room with one another, our working relationship became very natural, very encouraging and very positive as far as back and forth. I would write something, send it to her. She would read it and make some adjustments and send it back. And then she would do the same thing. And so we went round and round a couple of times trying to figure out what sort of tone and story that we wanted to tell. One of the first iterations we came up with was sort of an Ocean's 11 type idea. We wanted to take some of these characters, these actors, and place them in a situation where they were sort of like these con guys and they took down a big bad guy and that sort of thing. But for whatever reason, we took a different turn with it, and sort of it became much more of an Expendables type project, where we had a group of very elite, highly trained, highly motivated individuals who operated on the global stage, but without any sort of government oversight or supervision. So, you know, they would travel the world and take care of things that needed to get taken care of. And this was a group called The Order. Because we wanted to make things interesting, we had the idea that this highly motivated, highly trained group, something would happen that would divide them right down the middle. And then they would start battling one another. So you had the best of the best fighting the best of the best. And because we wanted to capture some of the flavor from the show, where you had these amazing martial arts and stunt-oriented actors who could do these fight scenes, who could handle these fight scenes, and place them in a situation where that would happen fairly frequently. So it was very challenging for us to sort of like try to write a script for 15 people to make sure that everybody had enough screen time, that everybody had enough of, you know, special moments where they stood out and so forth and so on. And we worked on it for a good 3 months to get the first draft of the script done. And then we polished it a little bit more And Karen said, okay, well, I'm going to take it to the guys. And we were both kind of scared about it because Catherine and Nakia and other the actors have been approached before with different scripts and for different projects. And they've never really worked out for one reason or other. Either the financing fell through or the script that they were given just really wasn't up to snuff. And so we were really, really nervous approaching them about it. And Karen got everybody together and passed out the scripts and said, you know, read it, take the night, get back to us and let us know if this is something you'd want to be a part of. And I guess within the first couple of hours of leaving them, her phone started to get blown up by people. this is fantastic. I'm in. And we were really happy that they enjoyed it. So, and then 3 months after that, I guess we were out in LA and we filmed the proof of concept trailer that's out there on the Kickstarter. And when the fans saw it, it kind of blew everybody away. And we were really, really excited about it. And we did really well with the Kickstarter, and we were, I guess 8 months after that, we were all in LA. All of us were there. We had all this, we had all the locations set up. We had all of the sets, ready to go. We had the camera equipment, we had everything. And then SAG stepped in and shut it down. And, apparently there were some I's that didn't get dotted, some T's that didn't get crossed as far as the proof of concept that we shot. There were some fines that were levied and it kind of wiped out a lot of our financing. So we had to go back to square one, and that's where we've been since that time, trying to recoup, trying to get back on track and trying to get it up and going. And one of the ways that we've tried to keep interest in it alive is we did the graphic novel, which is a prequel story that leads into the story of the movie. And the first volume of that is out there now. But it's still in production. It's still happening. And Karen and I were talking about it while we were in Peru. And there's some things in the pipeline that I really can't talk about. But there's some good news and some people that are interested. So hopefully it's going to get made. It will get made. it's just a matter of again, making sure that everything's paid for and up and everything's done right. So.
Right.
Welcome.
Well, I'll tell you, I think we're excited about it. You know, looking at just the IMDb page and who is on the project, you know, we could take a pretty good guess at how this came together. But as you describe the genesis of it, it begins with a description of something where I say, yeah, I'd watch that, or, oh, yeah, I'd watch that. And the ideas get better and better. So, you know, I want to wish you a little more than good luck with this. I want to wish you an awesome application of skill here.
Yeah. Have you seen the trailer?
Not just yet. I actually was not aware that there was a trailer. So I am going to have to check that out just as soon as we're done here.
Yeah, please do.
And we'll link to that in our show notes as well. All right. And also I need to point out to anybody listening right now, it looks like they also got James Bond.
Yes. I was looking at that.
Yeah, because we have such a large convention family, there are a number of people that are excited about it and said that they would help if when things got going. So we're very excited to be able to work with some of these people.
Awesome. So, David, what do you have going on the horizon? What does the future look like for you?
In the next couple of months, I have a new novel coming out from Caffeine and Ink called Glimms. It's a paranormal urban fantasy, which is part of a series. And I'm very excited about that. I'm supposed to be having discussions with the publisher about the cover for it this weekend. So that I'm looking forward to that. Then just upcoming convention appearances. I'll be in Silicon Valley on the 15th, 16th of this month, and then at Bubba Fest in Knoxville, Tennessee at the end of the month.
All right. And again, we'll put up some links in our show notes. So, David, at this point, we thought it would be fun to discuss a film with you that you had nothing to do with, but that you would be interested in exploring with us.
No, nothing at all. I just watched it. And, I mean, it's a sequel to a film that has a lot of meaning and nostalgia for me. So,
And what would that film be, David?
Blade Runner 2049.
Oh, be still my heart. Well, hey, David, before we get into this, first of all, let me just say thank you for inducing me to rewatch this movie before our conversation. I like bad movies and I love great movies. And I think you can guess which category I put this in.
I can't guess, actually, so I don't know.
I think it's awesome.
Okay. I am in that camp as well. I went into it expecting not to like it. I went into it very definitely with my arms crossed and with a stern expression on my face, expecting to hate it. I dared it. I physically dared it to impress me. And I think that was sort of the right attitude to go in with, because when it started, I was very full of myself. I'm like, oh, this movie's gonna suck. It's not gonna be very good at all. And you know, how can they ever, you know, how can they compare it to Ridley Scott's Blade Runner? This is gonna be. But 10 minutes into it, I was like, huh, okay. And then half an hour in, I was like, well, you know what, this is okay. And then you know, about the 35 minute mark, I was like, oh, this is pretty good. This is pretty damn good. And by the end of it, I was like, this is better than the original. This is, for me anyway, what a sequel should do. It took the premise from the original and expanded on it and made it its own. And it was just awesome. I mean, from a completely cinematic experience, the lighting, the coloring, the soundtrack, the music score, all of the elements that they put together to create these works of art, there was so much going on that it really behooves you to watch it multiple times so you can catch all the subtleties and stuff. It's just really, really well crafted, and I loved it. So,
you know, I think I went in with almost exactly the same attitude as you did. To me, the original Blade Runner is up there among the best movies ever made. And for me, when I'm going in there wanting to enjoy a movie, or when I do enjoy a movie, there are basically two things I'm looking for. There's strong writing, and also I'm looking at the photography. I want to see fantastic cinematography. No. And in this sequel, you know, the opening vignette works as a short film all by itself.
Right.
We begin with that dead skeletal tree in the poisonous fog, basically describing the state of life in the Blade Runner world. We see Ryan Gosling come out with his jacket weirdly over his mouth. Yep. If you're not coming in from the previous movie, you get some characterization of you know, his hard-boiled Sam Spade role right there. And right away, you know, when we see Kay, Ryan Gosling's character, and first replicant, whose name I can't recall, they're both beautifully framed in silhouette against the windows inside this character's house. And right off the bat, we're being told that he gives a damn. And by the time this little segment is wrapped up, you know, we've got the symbolism of Kay, who we learn pretty quickly is a replicant himself, washing the blood off his hands, giving an indication of his emotional separation from his job as, you know, a contract killer of robots who are basically human themselves. And yet this moment is juggling an emotional separation felt by a skin job himself.
Yeah, Dave Bautista, Sapper. The character's name is Sapper.
Sapper, all right.
What I love about the whole framework of Blade Runner, and this includes the first one too. The first one came out in 1982, and I was 19 years old. So I was completely enthralled with the atmosphere. I'd never seen anything like it before on screen. Here was this California that had been Tokyonized. You know, all the neon, all the flying cars, the rain, you know, it kickstarted that cyberpunk visual style that just oozed atmosphere, and it was so wonderful. And plus, it was a callback to the noir films of the 40s, where, like you said,
absolutely,
you know, these Sam Spade type, everybody was smoking. There was, you know, line, you know, smoke drifting through the air. It just drew you in. And so, you know, you forget, you know, what the theme of the movie is all about. And I think that's one of the things that makes that movie great, and what makes Blade Runner 2049 great, is that the theme of the movie gets subsumed into your subconscious. Because both of these movies are about slavery. And the horrible effects of what happens to slaves when they're used up or whatever. And looking back on the original after you know, immersing myself in Blade Runner 2049 12 or 15 times, and starting to you know, note some of the things that might not have bothered you about the original Blade Runner, but now that you really get bothered by. Like the character of Deckard in the original Blade Runner, he's not very good at his job. he kind of bumbles his way through the whole thing. And I think that adds to the mystique of, you know, the debate that raged for such a long time about, is Deckard a replicant or is he a human? That whole question. You know, because the writers say that he's human, but, you know, Ridley Scott will tell you that he's a replicant. And when you watch the original and see how many mistakes the guy makes and just sort of like bumbles his way by luck into, you know, taking care of business. And it's very interesting. And what's contrasting to that is how observant and good at his job that the character of Kay is. He, in that first opening sequence, he's sitting in the flying car after taking care of Sapper, and something catches his interest, like out of the corner of his eye. It's almost coincidental that he picks up on it. Anybody else might have just gotten back into their car and flown home, and that would have been anything. Nobody would have known anything. Mm-hmm. The story would have ended right there. And there's a couple of instances in the movie where that happens. One of my favorite moments of all is when he returns to that location after the box has been dug up and is going through Sapper stuff, and he finds the kid's sock, and then he goes back out to the tree. And again, there's that moment of observation where he sees something half buried in the dirt, and he moves the dirt away, and that's where we see the date for the first time. And his reaction to that is so good. It's filmed so well. about how he's so shaken to his very core by what those numbers represent and how he stands up and backs away from it. It's just done really, really well. And there are a lot of elements that are just really, really well done. I'm really looking forward to the director's version of Dune that he's doing now. So, I mean, if he does with Dune what he did with Blade Runner, that movie is going to be amazing.
Absolutely.
That movie is amazing.
You know, as you're talking through this scene, something that I'm thinking about is that, you know, you can experience Blade Runner as a sequence of pictures, either film.
Mm-hmm.
You can experience the emotional texture of it, and it mixes in with the visuals. Blade Runner has a quality of melancholy to it with texture that is maybe the only melancholy that you want to handle and be a part of. But to make all that work and to make Kay's investigations and his interactions work, the film has a lot of confidence in its own pacing. It's not in a hurry to do anything. Right. You know, you talk about the reveal of the serial numbers on the bones. If this were in a 90-minute movie, they would have had that done in three edits.
Yeah.
But the movie takes its time. And the only other modern-ish film that does that the same way is it's very much the same pacing as in 2001 A Space Odyssey.
Right. Very much so. I mean, it allows the observer, the movie viewer, to sort of step into the scene, you know what I mean? To become a part of it. I mean,
we're breathing at the same pace as the scene.
Yeah, and I wish I had seen it in a better movie theater. The movie theater we have here is okay, but it doesn't have like the best visual screen and whatever. But the thing that really impresses me the most about that movie is the soundscape, the music. Vangelis's score for the original one is so iconic, and you know, people were like, you can't mess with Vangelis's music. It's up there on a pedestal and you can't touch it, you know, get away from it. And knowing that Hans Zimmer was going to be doing the score, and he's very prolific. He also is prolific because he uses a lot of other composers to help bolster his work and stuff. But the music for Blade Runner 2049 takes all of the themes that Vangelis had and does what the film does. It expounds on it and makes it better. And not only that, but whenever you're in the city, there's that repeated machine-like sound of either like a train taking off or a plane taking off. And it's an audio reminder that you're in a different place. You're in a different time.
Yes.
And it's just really, really well done. The use of light and shadow is just phenomenal. It's just really, really well done. I mean, some of it's very over the top and heavy-handed. Like the one of my least favorite aspects of the show is the Wallace character played by Jared Leto. I mean, he's very obviously the bad guy. The first time we meet him, he's completely in shadow. And, you know, he walks into the light. So, I mean, it's
oh, but he has to do that. Come on.
I mean, we do that because we get to see the fact that his eyes are all augmented or whatever. So we know that he's not human as most other human beings are. He's you know, he's got plugins. He's been, you know, adapted for cyberware. I mean, he's more human than human or less human than human, however you want to put it. Because personally, for me, the most human character in the whole movie is Kay. He's a replicant, but his whole journey is about, you know, being able to be human. And I just think it's an amazing character arc. And I was actually fooled in the movie, because up until the moment when the other replicant tells him, "Oh, you thought it was you," I was convinced it was him. I was convinced that he was Deckard and Rachel's child. I was like, it's him. He's the child. And then when they did that final little twist, I was like, you son of a bitch. And so I really like the fact that the movie was able to trick me and didn't allow me to know what was coming. And I thought that was great.
It would have been perfectly safe for them to go ahead and, you know, make Kay the son of these two and carry on the story from there. And we would probably continue on in this conversation with the same enthusiasm that we're having. But sure. I appreciated that twist so much. And also, you talk about the what does it mean to be human theme. I think that was probably the hardest piece that they had to expand upon in this story. Because you talk about the controversy of whether Deckard is a replicant or human in the first film. Our wonderings are very quickly answered for Kay in this one when Police Chief Robin Wright remarks upon him lacking a soul. And when I saw that initially, I thought that was way too heavy-handed. But on my viewings after that, it gave a lot of room to expand upon this exploration. I think about the character Joy, the hollow girlfriend, as being like a less human foil to the otherwise pretty human Kay. You know, he may not have a soul, but we recognize his emotional condition. So does Joy. But Joy herself is very clearly a piece of software. She can be paused and dismissed with the push of a button. She flickers in and out when she's damaged. She's a servant to Kay. And when she says, "I love you," before being reduced to crushed plastic, it's a powerful moment. But then, you know, it's off to the recycling bin with her, and we're left to wonder, was there any real substance to that? And therefore, is there any real substance to Kay's apparent emotions?
Well, I mean, I think it's a great metaphor for things that are actually happening in the real world right now. I mean, there are people who have relationships that are completely internet dependent. They've never met in real life. They've never shared a meal together, but they have a very strong emotional bond, which is, you know, exactly what Kay and Joy had. And I mean, those moments are really, really impactful. I mean, when Robin Wright tells him, "You've been doing really well without one all this time without a soul," the look on his face is like she just stabbed him in the heart. I mean, it's obvious that he feels something, but of course he can't say anything because, you know, he can't. He's a replicant. And going back to that moment where, you know, the revelation comes up where he finds out that it's not him. To me, that is such a real world moment. It's like, yeah, nobody in life gets what they want. It was just a reinforcement of the human condition on this guy. Not getting what you want makes you human. And so for him to sort of like have this fantasy, this half hidden, half whispered fantasy that he won't allow himself to believe up until that point where he does believe it. And then it's snatched away from him again. I mean, that's a gut punch, man. I mean, really, a gut punch.
Absolutely. I love that. In both films, we see pretty incontrovertible examples of humanity from the replicants. You give you give some of the most powerful examples in 2049, looking back at the original Blade Runner. I also think about how loneliness is a major theme in both films. It's felt or, you know, replicated by both humans and replicants. In both films, you can be very much anonymous in a crowd, in a city. You get the sense in the original film that the dearest personal connections are felt when you buy your meal from the guy at the little food stall thing. But then you look at what the replicants are doing. There's nothing really tying them together except for common experience. But in the original film, they have the only family unit that we see in this universe. Up until the very last scene of 2049. And that's powerful stuff.
Sure, sure. I mean, and again, I mean, the underlying theme the underlying theme of slavery, the fact that these are slaves, they were created for a purpose. They were created to work. They were created to be used up, to be cast aside, and that's it. And the fact that, you know, it's all about, the films are about showing them having these human moments is reminding you that slaves are human. They're not aliens. They're not outsiders. And so I think that's a very powerful message. And it's one of the things that great science fiction does is teach you a lesson or to remind you that your condition is the same condition as the guy across the street from you or the guy in the coffee shop. We're more and more alike than we are different. And so that whole underlying theme of Wallace's whole thing about trying to create a synthetic life that can also give birth, you know, the God complex of that is very subversive but I mean, it's such a great theme, you know, to try to bring to light and to tell people about. And again, I mean, it gets kind of lost in the shuffle of everything else that's happening in the movie because finding the child becomes, you know, a much more of a focus than other things. But I think it's just really, really well done.
Yeah, that's very much my conclusion as well. You know, I will say that in the context of the theme of slavery, there's some fun moral ambiguity to navigate with Kay's relationship with Joy. Kay is born into his servitude, and that's presumably all he knows aside from his implanted memories. But he has a woman on a leash himself.
Yeah.
And the film does not so much forgive that as just present it and trust the viewer with their own contemplations of that.
Well, I mean, I love the fact that Kay is such a repressed individual. He is reminded, you know, on the hour that you are less than. I mean, there's that first scene of him walking through the police station where he kind of, that one policeman jumps at him and he ducks out of the way of, you know, the constant reminder that you are lesser than, and him not allowing himself to develop a, you know, relationship with a real person. Like when the prostitutes come up to him in the food court and she's like, oh, you don't like real girls, do you? And so I think that's just a function of his repressive nature of like, I can't have the real things, so I'm going to have what I can. But I agree. I mean, keeping her, and well, I mean, he kind of lets her off the leash with the Emanator, doesn't he? I mean, he sort of frees her from the apartment and brings her outside, but it's still in his...
He does, but there's still an off switch on that little remote control.
Right, and he has her in his pocket, which is another big
mess. Right, literally.
Yeah. It's like, wow, okay, yeah, you have a girl in your pocket, you know, okay. I mean, after rewatching it a number of times, and you see the actress that plays Joy, she shows up at different locations throughout the game because Joy, I mean, throughout the movie, because Joy is a universal, what's the word I'm looking for? She's a universal character. Anybody could buy Joy off the street, right?
Right.
We see her in different costumes, and you know, there's, you know, she's the bunny toy. She's the ballerina dancer. She's whatever you want her to be.
And, the anime version. Yeah, yeah.
And there's that scene where the giant version of her jumps down. She goes, "You look like a really tired Joe." So for her to, you know, to call him Joe, that's the only name that she has in her programming. You know, it's not the name that Kate wants to be called, but it's the only name that she knows. So, I mean, it's...
And that was another oof moment right there, because when that version of her creates that name again, yeah, it's another moment where the affection and the feeling and the thinking that we can imagine her experiencing and having and going through is, you know, just thrown off into the ones and zeros again.
Yeah. And it's another dagger in his heart. I mean, you know, it's just like, ugh.
Absolutely. Hey, I want to ask you a dumb question. Okay. So the Dreammaker character, she's living in isolation, creating fantasies as a world for herself to experience, and she's giving something else to other characters that enrich their lives. But there's literally physical separation between her and the world around her that she can't engage with. Do you find a Zordon connection there?
No. I mean, I didn't think you would ask that. I mean, but I mean, how many of us actually have that in our lives right now? How many of us do have a wall between somebody we might care about, or an estranged parent, or an estranged friend, or whatever? I mean, I think we all have that barrier at some point. So I thought it was a very interesting choice that they made her with like autoimmune deficiency or whatever it is that keeps her trapped in a bubble. Because, you know, what's Decker going to do now that he finds her? He's not like he can take her out of there. You know, so
it looks almost like a prison visit at the very end.
Yeah.
Hey, David, thanks for getting out there and engaging with your fans the way you do. And thank you also for sitting down and spending some time with us tonight. This has been a lot of fun.
How can people find you and connect with you online?
They can find me on Twitter at David J. Fielding. They can find me on Instagram at DJFielding_Zordon. And if they search for Zordon on Facebook, they should find my Facebook page. I don't know what the actual URL address is for that, but I'm out there. But yeah,
and we'll link to all of that in our show notes. And Dasmi, how can people find us?
Well, Snaked, you would just need to point your IRC client to irc.freenode.net, and we're in the channel Skiffy, SKIFFY.
And we hope to make some new friends by putting this out there. David, once again, thank you for sitting down with us. This was a lot of fun.
Oh, I appreciate it. I'm happy to come on, and it was a great conversation. Thanks for giving me the chance to be on.